As we continue in this look in the story of the Gospel of Luke and in the work of Jesus, we're going to do our very best to pay attention to some of the key concepts that will come up in some of these sections. Hopefully, as we do so, it'll be enriching to your faith and you'll have an opportunity to not only grow, but at times, continued study of the Bible can challenge you to change your perspective on life. Your perspective on life after, and how the space between plays out. And so before we get into our study, though, let's bow our heads together in prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for today. We thank you for the blessing that it is to be near the throne of grace and that you listen to our heart. Help us this morning to be good students. Help us to understand the space that we reside in the kingdom and in the world, and understand our role. Please forgive us of our sins, and this is our prayer in your Son's name. Amen. All right, so in the Gospel of Luke here, we are looking at, right now to start with, chapter 7, about verse 36, going through the third verse of chapter 8 as our first of three possible texts to look at. And this is one of the unique sections in the gospel accounts that makes it a little bit different than a lot of the Old Testament texts. There's a number of things that separate the instructional and literary style of the New Testament as compared to the Old Testament, even though they both share a tremendous amount of sympathetic terms, ideas, and concepts. What you see here is a much more familial, close relationship between not only God, but all of the participants in the story that is being unfolded for us, that really doesn't show up in the same ways in the more compact narratives of the Old Testament. Even if you think about Joshua, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, when they record similar type events, they are very compressed. In the narratives of Ruth, or in small segments of Esther and Judges, you do get a little bit more insight into the relationship of the participants, but not this ongoing developed kind of starting point, maturing point, sequence that occurs with the close disciples, which we refer later to as the 12, or some of these other individuals that are highly repetitive in the text. They show up a lot. They do get classed together and grouped together at times. And so this is one of our first interactions like that. Jesus's interaction with women in the text is different than its culture and the Old Testament in at least two big ways. Number one, he has a public, open relationship with women who are not family and not his spouse on a friendship level, on a close, committed, we are friends with one another context that is uncommon in the rest of the Bible and the rest of the narratives of the Old Testament. But it's also culturally uncommon to have that level of sympathetic relationship in first century text and first century environments. That's not how these cultures, the closer you get to Jerusalem, behaved. Outside of Jerusalem, yes, all these things are possible. But the closer you get to Jerusalem, the structure of the community there wasn't built in that way. And so when we see these things, we're going to be presented with a lot of opportunity to kind of reflect upon, this is what Jesus does in that relationship. This is what we've done in our relationship. What are we doing different, and how can we change? Because he is, again, master teacher, number one, our example, number two, and God. And so those things in the sequence of thinking of them through are going to be important for us to kind of pause, consider, and reflect. So, text begins, verse 36, and we're going to read part of it, probably not the entirety of all of these to kind of keep the focus well. But it says this way, one of the Pharisees asked him to eat with him, and he went into the Pharisee's house and reclined at a table. And behold, a woman of the city who was a sinner, when she learned that he was reclining at the table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of ointment, and standing behind him at his feet, weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head and kissed his feet and anointed them with the anointment, Now, when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, "If this man were a prophet, he would have known who and what sort of woman this is who is touching him, for she is a sinner." And Jesus answering said to him, "Simon, I have something to say to you." And he answered, "Say it, teacher." So there's, on the textual side, there's two levels of this dialogue. We're seeing the narrative, which is coming externally from the participants. Hey, this is what's going on. And we're probably familiar with the story, right? Is this story a familiar one to everybody? Like, we know it, we've heard it, we've seen it. But what's giving us is that internal monologue. Hey, you know, if this guy really was a prophet, he'd surely know this woman's history. He's about to get his answer, right? Like, he's totally about to find out that what he is asking is going to be answered. Tonally, both in the original language and the translation, can you sense his attitude about this woman? That's a very common perspective. There's at least two key New Testament texts that also kind of connect to it. Most of them have to do with the way in which marriages were examined. The marital relationship in the New Testament text, the way the Pharisees approached it, was pretty much exclusively in both conversation and in their literature from that era. Women were discarded if the marriage was defiled, but men were free to continue to do whatever they wanted. That's kind of the dialogue that takes place. Jesus actually explores this also in his response to the woman who was caught in adultery and rebukes the crowd. So you have two marital things that kind of show this attitude about male-female place taking its spot. Recognize that that reality doesn't change the biblical order. In fact, it's a further perversion of the biblical order. It's actually making one level of perversion now worse if we go into the text itself and think about some of those consequences. But right here, the whole context is pretty simple. Now, from a literary standpoint as well, and from like a connecting to the Bible story, recognize that there's some great spiritual truths taking place here. Her actions in blessing Jesus, she takes her glory, which is her hair, remember that's a New Testament concept, and submits herself at the feet of Jesus, and with her tears and her glory, she anoints him with this alabaster flask, this flask of alabaster. And so you see that she's engaged in tremendous humility. Even being there was a humbling decision on her part to honor and glorify the anointed one of God. And so she, her role there in many ways has nothing to do with sometimes how we jump later in the narrative. We start talking about Simon and his response. She's in a place of prophetic importance. And so her role there really is forward-looking. It's resurrection-focused. It's a common thing to take place to a certain degree culturally in that times. But right now it's super significant because it kind of kicks off the next phase of the work of Jesus, because now he is anointed to his task. And so this is a similar linchpin as the baptism would be in other ways. And so you can kind of think about them that way. But what did you guys see in the text here before we kind of get to the resolution side and think about it a little bit more? What else do you see in these first the first narrative chunk, the first teaching chunk of the text? Rich?
So I like how you mentioned that there's this internal conversation. And we do it all the time in our own heads, right? But Jesus is answering his question, which I think is amazing. But I think it's also important that people can tell when you have a certain look or a disdain for someone else. People can see that right off the bat. And we need to be very careful about that ourselves as well. So I think that's kind of an important point, kind of the way Jesus sees people, the way, say, like the Pharisees are seeing people. That's quite prominent in a lot of this, and how we treat each other.
Yeah. Bobby?
He was judging this lady, said she was a sinner, well, he was too.
Yeah, I mean, we learn, we know he is by his behavior because we get to read his heart. And the text shows that. Also note this, there is no denying her past. Nowhere in the text does it kind of whitewash her prior history. What you're seeing is in part what Rich identified is how we respond to it. The response of Simon here as in the text is, on one level, kind of reasonable with the ritualistic purity expectations for Israel. She's unclean. But you can respond to uncleanness in a number of ways. And your nonverbals is kind of like how you behave versus what you say often betray your actual attitude. So if you look disgusted but put on a smile, you're still disgusted. You're just faking it. That's what we're seeing on the inside. Now, what we don't know is the space between her history and today. It's entirely possible that at some point she repented and returned and re-engaged with the spiritual community of Israel. But they are still judging her on her past. And that past could have been yesterday. It could have been that morning, and they were still judging her on that past. Debbie?
In verse 30, it's amazing. They go right to attacking Jesus' credentials, you know. If he were really a prophet, he'd know what kind of woman, or she'd know what kind of woman she was.
Yeah. If you actually knew what you were doing, insert your job, then you'd know that I'm right. Insert your complaint. That's what you see there as a structure. Now, again, this is a story in the text designed to teach us biblical truths. And so everything here has the echo of inspiration. So we're seeing a lot of things that we wouldn't necessarily always catch.
Kind of makes you wonder why the Pharisee would have let her in his house.
Yeah. Like, how'd she get in there? And part of that is we tend to think of houses with closed doors and fences. First century homes aren't like that. They are either more equivalent to super compressed tenement housing or row houses, like you see downtown, you see home after home after home, but they're all interconnected and they have communal kitchen spaces a lot of times. And so, yeah, you can straight up wander into one of those less affluent homes. All the people with money in this section would have not been Israel. They would have been oppressors. And so there's some of that too. Donna? And she's doing the thing that should be happening, but he's thinking what everyone is thinking, Simon here. And so there's that conflict there. And again, he didn't even see her right away. You know, so there's a lot of this picture, like how many people are there? Where was the Pharisee? What goes on here? Is this him being hospitable? That's a fair response of him being hospitable. Pharisees were still hospitable. We tend to think of them as paper-thin villains, Pharisees. They have black hats on, and they're the bad guys. Keep in mind, when you get to Acts chapter 2 and beyond, at the church in Jerusalem, are there Pharisees in that church? Yeah, are there zealots in that church? Sadducees? Yeah, they have the whole gamut. And they're still figuring it out. They're still struggling to stop being who they were and become who God needs them to be in all the ways that would play out. And so as much as we see them sometimes as a big kind of wall of paper villains that are just drawn on the page and say, these are all the bad guys, there are people with that same background who spend their life close to Jesus all the way through the cross and return to him that fit some of these settings and pictures too. So there's a lot more going on there, but we're seeing the inside. And it's important for us to catch that inside space. The text continues, picking up there, verse 41. And it's one of the ways that now Jesus responds to questions. We like it when we ask a question, the people just straight up tell us the answer, right? And if you go to the nursery and say, "Hey, you know, I really need a plant that's going to do, that's going to survive here, and this plant is going to be, you know, great in the front of my house." We want them to like point us to two plants and say, "Pick one." Okay, well, they say we, I say me. Like, I don't need 8 hours of instruction because I'm probably going to kill the plant anyway. So let's just get down to the end of the matter. So Jesus doesn't do that. He begins with a narrative that goes, "And a certain moneylender had two debtors. One owed 500 denarii and the other 50. When they could not pay, he canceled the debt of both. Now, which of them will love him more?" Simon answered, the one, I suppose, for whom he canceled the larger debt. And he said to him, "You have judged rightly." Then turning toward the woman, he said to Simon, "Do you see this woman? I entered your house, you gave me no water for my feet, but she has wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but from the time I came in, she has not ceased to kiss my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she has anointed my feet with ointment. Therefore, I tell you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much. But he who is forgiven little, loves little." And he said to her, "Your sins are forgiven." Then those who were at the table with him began to say among themselves, "Who is this who even forgives sins?" And he said to the woman, "Your faith has saved you. Go in peace." The Pharisee, Simon, sees the woman for the first time and judges her immediately. Jesus' introduction of the woman in the story form of it leads to him asking, "Do you actually see her?" Because the way we read that text, "Do you see this woman?" It should be understood and inferred that it's actually thought of as, "Do you actually see her? Like, how had she," like, kind of less point out, how had she been in this house so long and you not noticed that she was here? She was invisible to you. She only mattered to you when your calloused heart allowed you to judge her, and also question who I am. And so that's often us. We don't see people around us on a biblical level of their value until, for whatever reason, we need them. We need them because they justify our opinions. We need them because we can make them the others that don't matter. We need them because they are Pharisees and they're adversaries. We need them because they can finally help us. All those reasons in which we dismiss a population around us are in part what takes place here. Again, that's a perversion of what should be happening in Israel. Israel should be a light to the Gentiles. They should have been an encourager to the oppressed and cared for the weak. Then, in fact, they had, over their history, constantly flipped that table around and leached off of everything to their own gluttony. And so you kind of see all of that unfold slowly in Jesus' teaching, and it's an echo of the prophets as well. That also then leads us to the actual moral implications and the teaching part of the story. He gets his answer, right? If this man was a prophet. Does it sting deeper than just the straight answer we all want? It should, right? Because his question, like, if he was really a prophet, he'd know who she was. And Jesus' answer is, "I'm a prophet because I know who you are." And that's got to sting a little deeper. And in the story he tells, in the way that he tells the story, a parable, a teaching truth, it's super obvious how the Pharisee sees himself. So Pharisees did not deny their sin. They just thought they sinned less. So in the story, if the woman is the one who has sinned a bunch, that's a fair literary analysis of the text, and she's really thankful for it, couldn't he be just a little bit thankful? But he's not. And she gets her sins forgiven, which freaks everybody out all the time that happens. Anytime Jesus forgives sins on earth, which he does more than once, people begin to stress out about it. But here it happens in this context, in a space where you didn't expect it. So now we also have a little linchpin. Okay, on that day, her sins were forgiven. At that moment, her relationship to God is as strong as it can be.
The Pharisee wasn't showing the kind of love that God required of him. And sometimes we can be guilty of the same thing.
Yeah, there's a misunderstanding of what the relationship between God and man is in the theology of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And a perverted love. It's very carnal in its desires, as is taught by them as a general principle. Michael?
When I see Jesus talking about these two very drastically different behaviors, he's talking about these people and their behaviors, and I think about, you know, what application does that have to me? It makes me pause and ask myself, how would he describe me? How would he describe my behavior? Would I fall into one other category more than the other? I know which category I want to be in, but it does make me ask myself, you know, how would I be described?
Yeah. And in the text right now, we're talking about women specifically, because that's what the text talks about. Realize that this is a principle that reasserts itself from this point forward. The Samaritans discuss the same way. They're actually used in that same counter expectation principle where, well, wait a minute, the Samaritans are the bad guys, and yet they're doing the good thing. Well, wait a minute, these women are useless to us. Well, they're doing the good thing. In each of these cases, you see the oppressed demonstrate the right behavior as opposed to those who should be doing the right thing, very much like what you expect from the Sermon on the Mount's teaching. Blessed are those, and these are the marginalized, God is going to exalt you. And so you kind of see the way that God is teaching is by showing us a marginalized people, not rising up to become new oppressors, but rising up to serve. And that's, again, not the historical norm. Oppressors rise up, or oppressed rise up to become oppressors in history. Jesus' disciples who were oppressed rise up to become glorified by God and honor him in service, which is part of the shift of the kingdom. Kind of really interesting to kind of see all of that play out on the teaching side, at least for me, is to see those steps take place. And this sequence of stories doesn't end just here, because it actually continues a few verses into chapter 3, the same chunk here. Before we close those last couple of verses, any more thoughts on this part of it? All right, so verses 1 and following in chapter 8. Soon afterward, he, being Jesus, went on through cities and villages, proclaiming and bringing the good news of the kingdom of God. And the 12 were with him, and also some women who had been healed of evil spirits and infirmities, Mary called Magdalene, from whom 7 demons had gone out, and Joanna, the wife of Chuza, Herod's household manager, and Susanna, and many others who provided for them out of their means. Cultural flip-flop there. Every single one of the apostles had been called from their work, whatever they were doing, and said, forget it and come with us. Stop doing your job, come do this thing. All the women then were financing, in this part of the story, what was going on. They were supporting them. Now note, these disciples, the men, when their faith diminishes, they give up on it and they go back to work. And who goes to the tomb? Who's the first person to the tomb? Some of these same women. So there's a dynamic in the text, which is counterculture, counter-expectation, that shows this familial level, family level commitment of these disciples. And it's not just the women who kept their faith too. I mean, some of the disciples, the male disciples, were there too. But it's just kind of a neat ebb and flow as you're looking at all of this play out. And that's not exactly how we would expect it to take place, would we? When we define and describe these relationships in our lives today, how would you feel if you saw this take place? If you see a teacher come into a community, take 12 able-bodied workers, and say, stop doing your job and study with me. And a few women of different prominence in the community say, here's the money to do what you're doing. Kind of weird, right? But should it be? You know? Because it's not how we would do things. We would say, well, you know, those guys maybe work part-time, you know, and then they can earn their keep and still go after it in the American exceptionalism way, or they should work full-time a day and study at night, and we would find different solutions that satisfy our cultural anticipation of how this should be. Because the men should be the providers. That's an American expectation. It doesn't mean that those things don't have value and space in our culture. But that's not what we see taking place here, which again makes this a little bit otherworldly because it's not like what we would expect. The text never really deals with it much. It just says this is how it is. And it's not the only time. Does this same kind of thing happen a little bit in the book of Acts? Where we see women of prominence being willing to use their economic gains for the help of others? Yeah. Which again is an interesting look at what takes place. And by the way, it happens today too. There are congregations of God's people all over the U.S. and abroad that have this same kind of demographic empowerment for the work, where it may not come from what you would expect, but it comes from what God has blessed them with. That's all part of that picture. Any questions on this section or thoughts or important things that you read in the text that were valuable to you?
I think these women seem to be showing their appreciation for Jesus and what he had done for them. So they were willing to buy into what was going on.
Yeah, these are individuals who have been through at least two levels of transformation. Level one is what the text identifies here, in that they had experienced the release of demons, they had seen the power of God demonstrated, but that led them to their second level of transformation, where, like Roy points out, their worldview changed, and what mattered changed. And that shifted what they were willing to do. And the text places all of them here. Now, I want to make sure we make a good point here, that acknowledging all of these details, and this is the transition point to the next part of the text, doesn't change the biblical order for the home, for God's plan. We acknowledge all those things and recognize that what they're doing is coming out of a perversion of that plan and moving into the kingdom. First century standards, outside of what Jesus teaches and what his disciples teach, isn't the biblical standard either. Because just like Genesis to John, you have biblical culture and then the culture that surrounds the Bible's teaching. The same thing is true from Jesus to the cross. You have biblical culture, that's what God teaches, and everybody else's culture that surrounds all of that. Very often we think that because this happened back in 700 BC in a biblical community, that what they were doing was therefore biblical. Is not the case. The same thing is true here. They're coming out of a corrupted culture just like we do, and so they bring some of that corruption with them, and Jesus is teaching them how these relationships should be. Male and female, he created them. They are co-heirs in the kingdom, but they have different roles. I mean, it's just really simplified that way. But we very often equate roles with our cultural expectation for what that role would be. And that's not always the case. And so there's a lot of that going there. We also don't know the family stories of each of these women or men and what goes on there. Not all of that is revealed to us either. That brings us into the next part of the text, which starts in verse 4. And it is an introduction of one of the instances of a very familiar parable. Raise your hand if you have ever heard or given a sermon on the parable of the sower. Everybody has heard the parable of the sower in a sermon before, right? 100% of us. So that means we all know what it's about, right? Absolutely. But is it possible that our perspective on the parable is limited by our own experiences? Always. It's always limited by what we want, what we think, what we've been taught. In context, the parable of the sower exists as kind of an instructional tidbit. We tend to make the parable of the sower about everything. We say, I've heard it, parable of the sower, used in business conversations, talking about how, you know, you should really be spreading your ideas everywhere because you don't know how they're going to grow out, and so you just make sure you go out and you sell to everybody. I've heard it in home settings where maybe that's not the context for it. I've heard a lot of times by people who do not have any knowledge whatsoever of how farming works and how planting works. And I've also heard it by people who actually have really great understanding of how farming works. Very often we do those things, and having been one of the ones who have taken that expertise from the other corner and brought it over there, we miss the point. This is not about farming. It's not about making your crops grow really great. Because literally from a farming standpoint, every farmer I know who has expertise will tell you, this is dumb. Like, you don't do that with your seed because you know what seed costs? Money. Like, you're just wasting it when you do this. So clearly, this is not exactly a true, let's take the best earthly example and then see how it is in the kingdom. Jesus is doing something different here. So beginning verse 4, let's read part of the text here. Michael, do you want to read verse 4 for us? Verses 4 through 8, just for now.
When a great multitude came together, and they have ever received, presented to him, he spoke a parable. The sower went forth to sow his seed. And as he sowed, some fell by the wayside, and it was trodden underfoot, and the birds of the heaven devoured it. Other fell on rock, and as soon as it grew, it withered away, because it had no moisture. Other fell amidst the thorns, and the thorns grew with it and choked it. And other fell on good ground, and grew, and brought forth fruit 100-fold. And as he said these things, he cried, "He that hath ears to hear, let him hear."
Important tidbit about this. It appears in three of the Gospels in detail. And as you've already kind of highlighted, it's not actually about farming. So that needs to go off the table. It's not about crops. It's not about business principles or all those other things. It's given explanation almost immediately in its context. If you look at some of the ways it's dealt with in other iterations of the Gospels, they go straight into a explanation saying, look, this is me telling you about how the kingdom works. And so the reminder is, it's the parable of the sower where a sower goes forth, not the sower of all sowers goes forth. And so the biological principle you need to recognize is really simple. How does seed work? Here's the textual connection to a New Testament text. Is there anywhere else in the Testament where a seed is used to talk about the kingdom in any way or in our individual response to the kingdom? Maybe in 1 Corinthians, I don't know, maybe Paul talking about what happens with a seed when it's planted and it's died and it gives birth. There's a great text to tie to this one on an intertextual basis because they're really hand in hand because it's describing how the gospel works and how transformation works, and in this case, resurrection and transformation works. So now you have a sower, not the sower, that goes out and starts spreading seed everywhere. Doesn't care where it goes. What we care about is what happens afterwards. Because we know what's going to happen with seed, right? You're going to have all these outcomes. Jesus then uses the normalized outcomes to help us then understand how the gospel works, how the message of transformation, how Romans 1:16, which is the power of God brings us into the kingdom, how all of that plays out. And he uses a simple analogy of a seed, a parable of the sower. So now you think about it from that standpoint, which will lead into a later discussion of parables in general. Does the parable make more sense when it's in its limited use? It does to me, at least. Because I have tended over the years to think about it as, well, this is how farming should work, right? But I can tell you from when I think back to times working on the grass farm that if I had planted seed on the walkways, you're fired. Like, what are you doing with that seed? The seed goes over here in the ground that we prepared for it, so there's something else going on. Picture there is now simple. Let's see what happens. Let's see what happens in that sense. A more, if you want to have an American folklore connection, this is Johnny Appleseed. He's just going about the country, planting apples wherever they are and seeing what happens in the long run. And that's kind of, Johnny Appleseed is a derivative of that parable anyway. It's kind of the origin story for it. So what do you guys think about this parable from the standpoint of before we had the broader purposes of it, but in its context, coming just after this conversation with Simon and Jesus and the women context, Jesus shifts and Luke shifts to talk about this parable. I got my reasons why it makes some sense structurally, but I was curious to see what you guys thought about it. Michael?
When I think about my earlier comment about how, you know, that's Jesus talking about those behaviors, and then we go into this parable, and as we all sit here looking at this parable and thinking about our own behaviors, like it may be, not like it may be, I fall into this parable. You know, everybody does somewhere. You know, and again, just like the last section, where does my behavior put me in this parable?
Yeah. I see that connection a little bit in this way. Oh, Joe first.
Doesn't matter. I don't know if this is straying away from the parable, but what I see in this dynamic is Saul's conversion. When he was told by Christ, when he was warned that, what are you doing? And the dynamic that took place for the rest of Paul's trip to Damascus, to me, was one of the greatest sower of seed there is in the New Testament. He was converted, and he grew from that conversion, and he grew, and he grew, and he grew until he died. He became one of the greatest ambassadors for Christ throughout the New Testament. That's my takeaway from that. And that's, forgive me for talking about me a little bit, but I'm going to try and live by that dynamic. I try and live by that passion. Whenever I find myself straying from what I have confessed as a New Testament Christian, it will take me some time to get back on course. And from time to time, I make serious mistakes. But then when I reflect, I can see where I have learned from some of my errors.
Yeah, right. Sometimes we very, I got you, Bobby. We very much personify each of these different soils, and we think about it in that term, in that sense, that I'm going to go through parts of my life where I'm this kind of soil, and so the gospel is going to impact me in that way. One of the ways I see that here, though, is more narrow. That this is more about first interactions than it is about lifelong faithful commitment. And you think about what just took place in the home of Simon. Two different soils present to hear the gospel who responded to it in two different ways. One of them said, I'm going to give all the fruit I possibly can because of all the good that's been done to me. And the other one said, whatever. Look at that dumb tree over there making fruit. So on a narrow basis in this context, I think it's probably first best seen as day one with the gospel. What's the person's heart like? Can it be the next steps? Absolutely. You could have someone who comes back in contact with the gospel whose soil has been churned by life, and now the gospel takes root. But there are other parables that Jesus teaches that have more to do with our continued participation in the kingdom, where this seems most placed on those first encounters. And so that's kind of its primary space here, because that's just what they talked about, and that's just what's going on. That's the kingdom focus here. And when we give it that narrower space, we end up with a picture that says, that's exactly what it looks like. You talk to people about Christ the first time, and depending on what the churn of their life has been, when you give them the right seed, water, and blessing from God, they produce a ton of fruit, and some people don't. And there's part of that that's taking place in the text here too. Bobby? And so we can see that in our own experiences, in our own families at times. It's a story that repeats itself through humanity. Rich?
So I've heard this explained in many ways, obviously, as you all have. And when you're connecting, I see that you're connecting, you know, the previous interactions. And now you've got a great group of people that continue to gather around. So as I look at that, how do you, as we go and talk to people, how do we gain the common ground? And so when Jesus is speaking this parable, they're fairly agrarian type of people, right? So they're going to kind of understand. That's why he says, those who have an ear, let them hear. He's going to let them contemplate what he said. Those who understand will apply those things, right? So as I'm presenting the gospel, I need to understand. That person that I'm presenting to looks like they got a lot of rocks in their life. Or that person has been super hardened through all of his life travels. It's going to require different preparation for those particular folks to get to that good soil state. And how do we get there? But part of it is, we got to make the common connection. How do we interact with these people? And you connect that back to the women, and it's a term I've heard recently and something that I got to continue working on. It's that emotional empathy that we need to have towards people that may not live the same life that we do, or that are totally different than we are. But how do you connect on them at that spiritual level? And that's what you need to get to. And that's something... Even myself, I got to keep working on. So I kind of see it as a common ground. If we can start.
Yeah, you could think about it maybe in this way. And this is another analogy that connects to it. And we'll close off with this because our time has rapidly escaped us. For those who are gardeners of some kind, successful or otherwise, if you plant a seed in rock, straight up rock, there's no amount of water you can apply to that seed and you're going to see it germinate like it's not. It's just going to drown it. That matches the illustration that Jesus uses here in the text. But if the rock gets broken and pulverized enough and stops being rock and allows soil to exist, biomass to exist, will that seed germinate with enough water? So if you really wanted to stretch the analogy as far as you could, for some of us, we're still hardened by our sins and we need to be crushed in order to be receptive to the word is a way to think about the text in its larger setting here. And Jesus is just helping us understand how do people respond to his message. Some are the Pharisees. Doesn't matter how much water you give them, they're not going to grow. And some are good soil, and they're going to grow like crazy. That's it for our class time this morning, so we'll continue into the study of the Gospel of Luke next Sunday. I really appreciate everyone's participation this morning, and looking forward to today's worship and what comes next for us in this study as well. Thanks, everybody.